Vedanta Swami Prabhupada ki jai, Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Nitai Gopare Manande Hari Bol Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, All Grace to the Assembly of Devotees, All Grace to the Assembly of Devotees, All Grace to the Assembly of Devotees, All Grace to Sri Sri Guru Gaurango. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 6, Conversation Between Narada and Vyasadeva, text number 35. Word meanings, Yama Adibi, by the process of practicing self-restraint, Yoga Patai, by the system of yoga, mystic bodily power to attain the godly stage, Kama, desires for sense gratification, Lobha, lust for satisfaction of the senses. Hata, curbed. Muhu, always. Mukunda, the personality of Godhead. Sevaya, by the service of. Yadvat, as it is. Tata, like that. Atma, the soul. Adha, for all practical purposes. Na, does not. Shamyati, be satisfied. Yamadi bir yoga patai.
Yamadi bir yoga patai.
Kamalobha hato moho.
Kamalobha hato moho.
Mukunda sevaya yadvat.
Mukunda sevaya yadvat.
Patatmadha nashamyati. Yamadi bir yoga patai.
Yamadi bir yoga patai.
Kamalobha hato moho.
Kamalobha hato moho.
Mukunda sevaya yadvat.
Mukunda sevaya yadvat.
Tathatmadha nashamyati. Yamadi bir yoga patai.
Yamadi bir yoga patai.
Kamalobha hato moho.
Kamalobha hato moho.
Mukunda sevaya yadvat.
Mukunda sevaya yadvat.
tatat madha nashamyati. Translation. It is true that by practicing restraint of the senses by the yoga system, one can get relief from the disturbances of desire and lust. But this is not sufficient to give satisfaction to the soul, for this satisfaction is derived from devotional service to the personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Yoga aims at controlling the senses. By practice of the mystic process of bodily exercise in sitting, thinking, feeling, willing, concentrating, meditating, and at last being merged into transcendence, one can control the senses. The senses are considered like venomous serpents, and the yoga system is just to control them. On the other hand, Narada Muni recommends another method for controlling the senses in the transcendental loving service of Mukunda, the personality of Godhead. But his experience says that devotional service to the Lord, he says that devotional service to the Lord is more effective and practical than the system of artificially controlling the senses. In the service of Lord Mukunda, the senses are transcendentally engaged. Thus, there is no chance of their being engaged in sense gratification. The senses want some engagement. To check them artificially is no check at all, because as soon as there is some opportunity for enjoyment, the serpent-like senses will certainly take advantage of it. There are many such instances in history, just like Vishvamitra Muni's falling a victim to the beauty of Menaka. But Thakur Haridas was allured at midnight by the well-dressed Maya, and still she could not induce that great devotee into her trap. The whole idea is that without devotional service of the Lord, neither the yoga system nor dry philosophical speculation can ever become successful. Pure devotional service of the Lord, without being tinged with fruitive work, mystic yoga, or speculative philosophy, is the foremost procedure to attain self-realization. Such pure devotional service is transcendental in nature, and the systems of yoga and jnana are subordinate to such a process. When the transcendental devotional service is mixed with a subordinate process, it is no longer transcendental, but is called mixed devotional service. Srila Vyasadeva, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam, will gradually develop all these different systems of transcendental realization in the text. Om Jnana Timirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Today we'll have a discussion of different kinds of devotional service, pure devotional service and mixed devotional service. I'm going to be relying again on some of the commentaries of Acharyas, specifically Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Jiva Goswami. Now in this verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur brings out, he says this. This is part of what he says. He says, this verse must only refer to yoga and other processes mixed with bhakti. In other words, this verse is saying that, God, this is an important point. It says that you can get liberation. Does it say liberation here? You can get relief from the disturbance of desire and lust just by karma or yoga and jnana. Specifically, yoga is mentioned in this verse. So he's saying, well, you can only get that if there's bhakti mixed in there. That's his point. This verse must refer only to yoga and other processes mixed with bhakti, since they otherwise would give no result at all. And even if these processes pacify the Atma to some extent, they do not pacify it to the extent that pure bhakti alone, serving Mukunda without these processes, does. These mixed processes will not satisfy Atma completely. So you may get something from it, but you're not going to get liberation, really. You're not going to get satisfaction of the self unless bhakti is added to it. So then he quotes something here, some verse, but then after that he says, though bhakti is described here as a means of liberation, three types of bhakti are seen. So this is more or less what this I'm going to be talking about here in different ways, these three different types of bhakti. So he says there are three types of bhakti, pure bhakti or kevala bhakti. Now, a little later, if I can find it, here. At the end of his purport, he says, kevala bhakti, practiced by a person who is a nishkama, is also called ananya bhakti, shuddha bhakti, nirguna bhakti, uttama bhakti, and a kinchana bhakti. So these are synonyms for kevala bhakti. So kevala, of course, the word kevala means only or alone, or so in other words, there's nothing else there. It's kevala bhakti, only bhakti. So that's the first type of bhakti that's going to be spoken about, kevala bhakti, which was actually mostly what I'll be speaking about. Then there's mixed bhakti. It says, mixed bhakti, but with bhakti being predominant. So there's two kinds of mixed bhakti. When bhakti is predominant, it's called pradhanya mishra bhakti. Pradhanya, the word pradhan means chief. So pradhanya bhakti means you have mixture, but the main part is bhakti. It's mixed with something else, but the main part is bhakti. And then the other kind is and mixed bhakti, but with bhakti being secondary, that's called guna bhava. There's a lot of technical terms. One thing is, our acharyas, they use a lot of these technical terms. So they like to categorize things in different ways and put names on all of them. So we have pradhanya bhakti and guna bhava bhakti. Pradhanya, when bhakti is chief, mishra, and when the other thing, the jnana or the karma or the yoga is chief, and you add a little bhakti in, that's called guna bhava, mishra bhakti. So then he quotes, he says, Kevala Bhakti is illustrated with such verses as Chaktva Sadharmam Charanam Bhujam Hare. That's Narada Muni saying that even if you give up Varnashram and you take the devotional service and you don't perfect it, still there's no loss at all. And what's the gain if you just do all your duties perfectly but don't have any bhakti? So he says that's an illustration of Kevala Bhakti. And then he, quotes a couple of verses to show what Guna Bhava Bhakti is and what Pradhanya Bhakti. I have a lot here, so I'm not going to read those verses. But this is his last paragraph of this purport on this verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Kevala Bhakti gives prema as a practice, and then he gives all those synonyms which I just read. Gives prema as a result. Pradhanya bhakti, classified as karma mishra bhakti. Now, well, you'll notice the way these names are. When bhakti is at the end, that's the main one. So karma mishra bhakti means when karma is mixed in with the bhakti is the main thing. So that's pradhanya bhakti. So pradhanya bhakti, classified as karma mishra bhakti, jnana mishra bhakti, and yoga mishra bhakti. And practiced by those who are shanta. I think shanta here doesn't mean shanta rasa. I think it means shanta means peaceful. Produces rati, bhava, and liberation for some. So even these mixed bhaktis, they can give bhava. They can lead to bhava and liberation for some, he says. If one of these persons gets the association of a person with Dasya Bhava or other sentiments, so Dasya Bhava, I assume in the Sanskrit maybe it said Adi, something like Dasya Adi. So Dasya Bhava and other sentiments, in other words, the others also. So if you have this Mishra Bhakti but you associate with someone who's actually in one of these more advanced stages, because of the predominance of bhakti desiring dasya or other sentiments, that person will achieve prema from dasya or other bhava with a prominence of reverential mood. In other words, you can still get prema, but it's going to be aishwarya prema if you have some mixture in there. And you associate with someone who's actually, you know, in dasya or higher stages. Now in Guna Bhava Bhakti, so again this is when the other thing is predominant and not bhakti. It's just bhakti is there, otherwise there's no value really unless the bhakti is added. So when the bhakti is added to karma or jnana or yoga, it says bhakti does not reveal its own result and name. It is only an assistant of karma, jnana and yoga, which cannot produce results without bhakti's presence. Bhakti in this case is only secondary, tatastha. Tatastha, of course, the word means marginal. Bhakti Mishra, so now you'll see how the names, so this is the names when the other things are prominent. So then their name goes at the end. So you have Bhakti Mishra Karma. So when bhakti is mixed into karma, it's mostly karma, but you add a little bhakti. That's called Bhakti Mishra Karma, Bhakti Mishra Jnana, and Bhakti Mishra Yoga. Produce liberation, so you can actually get liberation, as I mentioned earlier. You can get liberation with this Mishra, but even with a little bit of bhakti. Interestingly, I looked up, because I was curious about, this is going to come up a little more later, the idea of jnana yoga. And I was saying, what is jnana yoga exactly? How is it done? So I looked on, there's a website called Yogapedia. So it's an encyclopedia of yoga. So I was looking at a definition of jnana there, and it talks about, of course, it's the path of knowledge. And it says, at least on this website, it said that it's really coming from, it's rooted in the teachings of Shankaracharya. So it's about studying Shastra, especially Vedanta Sutra, and it's about, you know, austerity, and it also includes meditation. But the meditation is on Brahman. But at the end of the definition, it said something about, because it talks about realizing God through this process. So I'm thinking, well, if you're meditating on Brahman, how are you going to realize God? Of course, they have the conception that Brahman is God. But then there was a line at the end of the definition that said also, you know, practitioners on this path practice bhakti, because without practicing bhakti, you won't get realization of God. So this was right on this. It was written by some Mayavadi, probably. They admitted that this person who was writing this admitted that the bhakti is important, because you have to have the devotion there to get the mercy of Krishna. So related to all of this, I was thinking, was our definition of, now getting back to Kevala Bhakti or Uttama Bhakti, how is it defined? Now we find that our acharyas, they're very careful, as I was saying, they're very careful at categorizing things and defining things. So this is the, of course, the famous verse, Anyabhilashit. So this is from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. It's in the first chapter, of the first section in text number 11. Now, you know, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it means not just nectar of devotion, but the ocean of the nectar of devotion is literally what the name means. And that ocean has four divisions, or four oceans, four parts of the ocean. And the first ocean is called the Eastern Division. So in the first chapter of this Eastern Division, text number 11, so right at the beginning of the book, we have this definition of what is Kevala Bhakti or Uttama Bhakti. So this is Anya Bilashita Shunyam Jnana Karma Dhyanavritam Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhakti Uttama. So Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, of course, was written by Srila Rupa Goswami. So this is the translation. This is Bhanu Swami. This is coming from Bhanu Swami's translation. The highest bhakti, Uttama Bhakti, is defined as continuous. It's the highest because it's pure. That's the idea. It doesn't have anything mixed into it. The highest bhakti, Uttama Bhakti, is defined as continuous service to Krishna with a pleasing attitude. It should be devoid of desire other than the desire to please the Lord, and unobstructed by impersonal jnana, the materialistic rituals of karma, and other unfavorable acts. So I'm going to continue, I'm going to read from Jeeva. There are two commentaries on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that we have, from our line directly, is Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So these, Bhanu Swami has translated these. They're in his edition. He published it himself, but then the BBT is also going to publish it at some point. I edited it several years ago. It's still in the process of being produced. But so there are these two commentaries. Jiva Goswami's commentary comes first, and then Vishwanath Chakrabarti's. Of course, Jiva Goswami chronologically does come first, too, because Rupa Goswami, then Jiva Goswami is writing his commentary on Rupa Goswami. And then Vishwanath Chakrabarti, quite some time later, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur wrote his commentary. And Bhanu Swami, he also writes, he calls his comments. So once in a while, hasn't written extensive comments throughout the book, but here and there he's given some elucidation, clarification on things to help us understand, because sometimes it's very difficult. It's very technical, but the Rasamrita Sindhu is very technical. So sometimes it's hard to follow what exactly being said. So Bhanu Swami helps in some places. As he has done, he's written quite an extensive commentary on this particular verse. So I'm going to bring out some of the points. Now what's interesting is both Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur have taken the verse word by word to explain the meaning. And one thing they pointed out is why Rupa Goswami has used these words. And sometimes what they've done, the commentators have said, well, someone may say, well, he didn't have to use this word because he just used this other word. So then Jiva Goswami or Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur will justify his use of the word. No, he had to use this word because otherwise this meaning would have slipped through, and this part of the meaning, the definition, is important. So that's being done. Now, the way they've both approached this, they've started by the end of the verse, the last line, the last two lines, Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhaktir Uttama. So Bhaktir Uttama, Uttama Bhakti, what is it? What are its characteristics? So instead of starting with Anya Bilashita Shunyam, they've started with the last two lines. And there's a reason for that. So Vishnu or Jiva Goswami, he begins by speaking about this word anushilanam. So the first thing he does is he says if you really want to understand a word, you have to really understand the root of the word. And the root of the word is shila. So krishnanushilanam is all one word. But then, of course, then you have shilanam, and then you have shila. Bring it all the way down to shila. So shila, he explains here, it means, well, actually, I think this is, Bhanu Swami is giving this translation. These are all translations of the word shila. It's a verbal root. To cultivate, practice, serve, worship, meditate, and contemplate. So then Jiva Goswami says, the meaning of this root is twofold. I'll give you the Sanskrit, actually. Pravritti Atmaka and Nivritti Atmaka. So, of course, Pravritti and Nivritti. So, Pravritti, of course, is a positive, and Nivritti is a negative. So, he says, Pravritti Atmaka is the meaning expressed through action. If you take this Shila, as you'll see as I go on here, really it's kind of boiled down to meaning serve. So it's about service. That's really the way it's being taken. Among these different definitions, it's about service. So active service is pravritti atmaka, and inaction is nivritti atmaka. So then he explains what, of course, action means. The word is chaishta rupa. Chaishta means action. So active service, well, we know what it means. We use our body, actually he says body, mind, and words. To use body, mind, and words, or body and words, I think, actually, he says. Well, he does say body, words, and mind. That's chaishta rupa. And then the bhava rupa is the other one, which is what was called nivritti, or negative, inaction. He says this is the emotional form of bhakti. So you have the active form, and I say the external, then you have the emotional form, our thoughts as we're executing devotional service. Then he gives examples. He says, like priti and vishada. Priti means affection, and vishada means despair. Then he explains that all of these must be saturated with shuddha sattva, pure spiritual. So then he goes on to explain Krishnanushilanam. So this was just about Shila, now Krishnanushilanam. So that Krishnanushilanam means relation, means service in relation to Krishna, or service for Krishna directly. So there are these two things. So we know this principle. You can serve Krishna directly, or you can serve things or persons, tadiyanam, samarchanam, something related to Krishna. Let's see. And then he says, in relation to the emotional, then this, what's being implied here is the higher stages, like Stayi Bhava, Sanchari Bhava, and these kinds of things that we hear later in the Nectar of Devotion, all the different parts of Rati or Bhava. So these are all, of course, active devotional service. Just like we say sometimes, well, you can serve Krishna just by, we can serve Krishna anywhere, because you can always remember Krishna, even if you can't physically serve him. If you're locked up in jail or something, and you can, of course, you can chant, but you can also just remember Krishna. So then he says, what about, why does it say Krishna here? Because obviously it's pretty obvious. It's about Krishna. Krishnanushilanam, serving Krishna. Krishna specifically, he says, in this verse, the word Krishna indicates Krishna, the Swayam Bhagavan, as well as all his other forms. This gradation, the gradation of these forms will be considered later in the second chapter. So then he goes on to the next word, anukulyena. Now he says here, the word anukulyena, which means with a favorable mood, is a descriptive element of anushilana, or service. So not only do you serve, so this is an example of why he's explained, why does this word have to be there? You think, well, it's just serve. You already said you have to serve. Well, it's not just any kind of service. It has to be favorable service with a favorable attitude. So this is called a descriptive. It's like an adjective for the service. So the service has to be favorable. Let's see here. So I'm just going to kind of skip through this part. There's quite a bit that he says about this, using some technical terms. But at the end, he says, Anukulyena Krishnanushilanam, continuous service or emotions directed towards Krishna, his expansion forms, or things related to him with a pleasing attitude, is the essential characteristic, Swarup Lakshana of Bhakti. So this is another indication why he started with the last two words, the last two things in this verse, the last two characteristics of Bhakti, Uttama Bhakti. Krishnanu Shilanam. Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam. So these two things, Anukul, favorable and service, devotional service, these are called the Swarup Lakshana of Bhakti. So this phrase actually comes up quite often, the Swarup Lakshana and Tatashta Lakshana. So Swarup means the main thing, and Tatashta means an additional characteristic. I was thinking an analogy, for example, with a person. All of us have, you might say, our main identity in a sense. Everyone knows us as just by the way we look, you might say. You might say that's the Swarup Lakshana of any person, what the person looks like. Maybe a general idea of their personality. But then Tatashta Lakshana means other things, like the things that they like, or the kind of car they drive, or the kind of house they live in, or these kinds of things. They're subsidiary characteristics. So there's the main characteristics, the most essential, you might say, and then additional characteristics. So that's the idea with Tatashta Lakshana and Swarup Lakshana, or Swarup Lakshana and Tatashta Lakshana. So he's saying these first two things, favorability and service, the service with a good attitude, these are the main characteristics of Bhakti. Let's see. So then we get to the secondary characteristics. So these are the other ones. This is the beginning of the verse. Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam. So anyabhilash means other, abhilash means desires. So they have to be shunyam. They have to be, you can't have them at all. You have to get rid of them. So how does he Jiva Goswami says, these are two modifying phrases. Should be devoid of extraneous desires. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm over. So here's his explanation of jnana karma dhyanavritam. So again, this has jnana, karma, and adi, anavritam. Well, first, anyabhilashita. So notice, sorry, I'm going on to the next one. Let me get back to this one, the shunyam. Anyabhilashita shunyam. So I think, yes, it's Vishwanath Chakrabarti in his commentary. He says, well, why, he raises the question, why isn't it just anyabhilash and not anyabhilashita? What is that ta doing there? So the way he explains it is ta means that it's really an intrinsic. And it's, if the desire is really in the core of your heart, you might say, then that's bad. But there may be some spontaneous outpouring of what appears to be a desire. And the example is given, actually Bhanu Swami gives this example based on what the acharyas have said. He said, just like Draupadi, she's a pure devotee, she's not supposed to need anything, but she's calling out for Krishna to help. So this ta means that's okay. Because it's really, you might say, not that she has, you know, these deep desires in her heart for protecting herself or whatever. This is, you might say, this is kind of like a material desire, I need to be protected. But it's just a spontaneous, accidental utterance that comes out. So that's okay, that's the idea. That's the explanation why that ta is there. In a footnote here, it says, this is called the instrumental case. It says, the instrumental case is used to indicate a specific nature of a thing or action. In other words, if it's intrinsic to the nature of that person or that thing, then that instrumental case is there, and that's what the significance of that suffix ta is. So let me read. So then the next thing, so that's about anyabhilashita shunyam. It has to be zero, no material desires. So then jnana karma dhyanavritam, so jnana karma and so on, the bhakti has to be anavritam. So avrita means covered. Krishna uses this verse and word in Bhagavad Gita. So anavrita means uncovered. It can't have any covering of jnana, karma, and so on. Yoga, for example. Actually, he gives a list of different things, but those are the three main ones. So then the question is raised here by one of the acharyas, well, why doesn't it say shunyam here too? Why doesn't it say no karma, no jnana, and so on? It just says not covered by them. So the indication is, now just a little aside here, what you're seeing here is the acharyas, essentially what they're saying is that Rupa Goswami has done this perfectly. This is a perfect definition of Uttama Bhakti. And they're justifying everything. That's why they're saying, that's why he used this word. It wasn't just an arbitrary word. The definition is not just arbitrary. It was very thoughtful and specific. So that's in the context of that, the idea is that, so why didn't he say shunyam, no jnana, karma, and so on? Because these processes can be dovetailed to devotional service. And that's the idea. And some examples are given here. Let's see if I can. I think in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's, where he writes about this. Jnana karma dhyanavritam. Oh, actually. Let me see what he says about it here. Jnana, knowledge, is the secondary phrase. In the second phrase, in other words, he's referring to Anyabhidhyasita Shunyam is one phrase, and Jnana Karma Jnanavritam is the second phrase. These are the Tatashta Lakshanas. So Jnana refers to inquiry concerning the undifferentiated Brahman and not to inquiry concerning the worshipful Lord. For that knowledge is necessary for bhakti. So this is another way we can see why the word jnana can be permissible. Because we also are interested in jnana, of course. But when we say jnana, we don't mean, you know, inquiry concerning the undifferentiated Brahman. We're not trying to understand how everything is one. We're trying to learn about Krishna. So that's a kind of jnana also. So that, of course, is justified and encouraged. The word karma in the verse refers to daily and periodic duties, nitya and naimittika, enjoined in the smritis, and not actions like serving the worshipful Lord, for such actions are the very nature of anushilanam, or service. The word adi, other unfavorable acts, refers to such practices as renunciation, vairagya, ashtanga yoga, and empirical study, sankhya. Let's see. I don't know if I've explained it clearly enough here. Let me go to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's discussion of this phrase. Oh, here. This is where he talks about it. The word shunyam, devoid of, is not used in the second descriptive phrase as it was in the first, namely anyabhilashita shunyam. The intention in using anavritam, not covered, instead of shunyam, is to forbid only those types of jnana and karma that eclipse bhakti. For example, faithfully performing nitya karmas, daily duties, under the authority of rules, and out of fear of sin or degradation if one does not perform them, is a covering of bhakti. In other words, if you think, going back to Narada Muni's Chakdvasa Dharmam Charanam Bhujam Harer, don't think that if you give up the ordinary duties, you're not going to get prema, pure devotional service, that you're not executing pure devotional service. Don't have that fear. You can give them up. Krishna says, sarva dharmam parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. So if you're thinking, oh, I have to do these karmas, people call their daily rituals their karma, there are two kinds, the daily duties and occasional duties. So he continues, also, performing them with faith that they will help one attain the desired goal of bhakti is a covering. However, a great devotee is not excluded from pure bhakti by performing shraddhas to the ancestors and so on, if it is done without faith that they are necessary for his bhakti, and just to teach the common people. So I'm going to wrap it up here. I'm just going to read, which tying into this, a comment that, let me see if it's right in the beginning of this. Yes. This is from Bhanu Swami's comment. So he says here, it should be understood that this definition of Uttama Bhakti or pure Bhakti applies to sadhana as well as bhava and prema. So in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, bhakti is put into these three main categories. There's sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prema bhakti. So he says that Uttama Bhakti or pure devotional service applies to all three categories, even sadhana. Even though a person at the stage of sadhana is not absolutely purified of material desires or false ego. Thus the term pure devotee, widely used in contemporary Gaudiya Vaishnava circles, including ISKCON, may be applied to persons not on the level of prema, the only condition of absolute purity. So you can be called a pure... If you're not thinking... So basically the idea is, if you're not thinking that, oh, I have to do these other things, I have to speculate on the absolute truth, of course, you may not tend to do that, but if you think I have to worship the demigods, for example, you know, I've always worshipped Ganesh, and, well, or it's in my family, and if I don't do that, then I won't be successful. Krishna Bhakti Gadi Sarva Kama Krita Hoy, Shraddha means to have the faith that I just have to serve Krishna. So if actually we realize that, if we have that faith, and we also don't think, well, I have to do yoga. Because, of course, there are people who are doing yoga because they're doing yoga because they actually think they're going to get some spiritual realization. And someone may come to Krishna consciousness with that idea, oh, I've been doing yoga for a long time. I feel like I still need to do my asana, my pranayama, and you know, my yoga meditation. Otherwise... Because this is my spiritual path, if I give this up, I'm going to be losing something. So if that's there, and it's then that's a problem. But we don't have that. But we're trained by Prabhupada. We don't think that, well, I have to come to the temple and practice my asanas, otherwise I'm not going to get pure devotional service. We don't think that way. We don't think that we need to speculate on the absolute truth or worship the demigods, for example. We're going to be missing out on something in our spiritual life. So that's the idea why it's justified, and I've always felt that's how Prabhupada used the word when he referred to his disciples as pure devotees. All my disciples are pure devotees, you know, that famous statement of Prabhupada. All of my disciples are pure devotees. That would be the reason, because we don't think we have to do something else. We know that if I just follow my guru, even though I'm just a child and I'm stumbling and falling and struggling and so on, still, this is the path of pure devotional service, and this is, we know, we're convinced that this is all we have to do. We don't have to mix in these other things. So we're not karma mishra bhaktas or yoga mishra bhaktas or jnana mishra bhaktas, even though we still have residual impurities within the heart. And by this definition, and this is confirmed here by the way this is being explained, uttama bhakti is when you've rejected these other paths and you just want to progress in spiritual life in pure devotional service, realizing you only have to serve Krishna to become successful. So I'll stop here. I'll read the translation again. It is true that by practicing restraint of the senses by the yoga system, one can get relief from the disturbances of desire and lust. But this is not sufficient to give satisfaction to the soul. For this satisfaction is derived from devotional service to the personality of Godhead. Shesha Prabhu.
Thank you. As today is Nirjal Ekadasi, do we have to practice Nirjal Ekadasi?
Do we have to?
In order to attain pure devotional service.
No, we can accept it as something favorable. We don't have to do these things necessarily. Prabhupada himself, he didn't. Prabhupada was very, you might say, his moderate in his austerities. It is recommended, of course, and sometimes Prabhupada would, sometimes he would criticize devotees as being too ease-loving, you know. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he also didn't like his disciples to be ease-loving. But it's not, I mean, this, it's the kind of thing where Prabhupada didn't come right out and say that this is essential for your advancement in spiritual life. But you know, one of the principles in Bhaktivedanta Sindhu is that you have the, you know, overriding instructions, and then the acharya gives the details. So there's a certain mood that Prabhupada gave us. So our austerities are other things, especially preaching. This is, I was thinking in the, you know, essential characteristics. So probably one of the main characteristics of Prabhupada was his mood of preaching above all else. Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, of course, we know that story about one of his disciples didn't feel that he could preach because he was supposed to fast that day. And he said, well, eat. If you can't preach without eating, then go ahead and eat. Eat something. So that was that's our austerity. Sometimes I hear, you know, devotees, I don't want to criticize anyone for doing this, but it's a hard thing for me to relate to. Devotees want to take these long treks in the Himalayas to go go someplace. And I think you would actually make more spiritual advancement just by distributing one Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. That was Prabhupada's mood, to give people Krishna consciousness. There's one, I came across one statement where Prabhupada said, the greatest exhibition of love for Krishna is preaching. So in any case, Prabhupada didn't give us a specific instruction that we have to follow near Jalai Ekadashi. Actually, I don't even know if there's the idea that if you've broken Ekadashi, you can not exactly make it up, but then you can fast. I don't even, is that even there in Shastra somewhere that you know somehow you're absolved from that by following upon Nirjala Ekadasi? I think it's just something devotees do, and it's become a sort of a tradition in ISKCON. I may be wrong, but I don't know if Prabhupada himself actually ever said that. Maybe if somebody has a reference citation, they can give it to me, but you know, ISKCON has certain lore. Some things that they happen to be. I mean, sometimes I hear devotees say, they'll mention some little rule that they follow, and they said, oh, we've always done that. We've always done that. I go, well, we didn't do that in my temple. I never heard of that. Prabhupada said, that's another one. Did he say? Show me. I want to see it. Madam Mati.
You're talking about, the conception, and we don't have that conception of we need yoga to do that, or, you know, Prabhupada trained us, you know, we don't need anything, we just perform pure devotional service. We don't think about, you know, jnana or yoga or whatever. But, and also we have the understanding, it's not like I have to follow the Varnashram system or something. But we do think, or as I can say for myself, that I have to do my duties of mm-hmm. being, living in this world, and whether it's wifely or motherly duties or whatever, I have to do those. Not that bhakti depends on those, but it's an essential element that, and I think I have to do those. Is that a Mishra Bhakti or what? Or is, because it's not just put, I mean, I guess it's putting the body, mind, you know, mind, body, or whatever, soul together. Maybe you can say something.
Yeah, like there was that mentioning of doing the Shraddha. We know, of course, Advaita Acharya did the Shraddha ceremony. Lord Chaitanya performed, he went to Gaya. So, somehow or other, even though these things are not, as you were speaking, I was thinking maybe you were going to mention like your parents, for example, because I know this is some concern also. So it's not exactly, of course, it's not Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasayam, it's not in that kind of nine processes of a devotional service, but it's supportive of it. Now, like Prabhupada would say, when someone asked him, you know, what is a characteristic of a devotee, they'll probably say to be a perfect gentleman, that idea. So the devotee doesn't neglect those things. He doesn't neglect ordinary duties, even though strictly speaking they're not devotional service. So somehow our service to Krishna encompasses these things. It's part of our life. You still have to live your life, so you can live like a reprobate. You can live like, you know, a dutiful person, not giving. In fact, I think that's even there in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, in one section where it talks about different rules. A devotee is not negligent in the ordinary course of affairs. I think it's something like, it's phrased something like that. So you don't neglect ordinary things. So how does that, you know, how is that classified? I'm not exactly sure. Of course, if it is one of the 64 items of devotional service, I'm not sure if it is, but I'm pretty sure it's mentioned as at least an instruction for devotees to follow. So then it comes within the umbrella of devotional service in some way, although you might say that technically it's not pure devotional service. Well, just like we may do different things, and then sometimes we say, well, I just need to spend some time hearing and chanting. You know, I'm doing so many things, but I need to really absorb myself in hearing and chanting, because we know that that's more focused, you might say, service. So these other things are supportive.
Would you say it's the consciousness that we're doing our daily duties, that it could be more Mishra or it could be pure, yeah, devotional service? Could it be pure devotional service?
I think we could put it that way, because in other words, if we go back to this definition in here, anukulyena, with a favorable attitude. So if one's thought is, I'm doing this for Krishna, Krishna won't be pleased if I, for example, neglect my children, don't take care of them. Krishna will be pleased if I do my duties in a nice way. Actually, when Krishna's preaching to the gopis, when they come to the rasa dance, and Krishna's basically saying, well, this isn't good, you know, given up. And now, I'm not sure if Prabhupada says it in the Krishna book, but somewhere the idea comes up where it says that Krishna is, in a sense, he's teasing the gopis, but on the other hand, what Krishna's saying is true. It's not that this is just a joke. But no, it is true. You should take care of your duties. So especially if you think, well, I'm doing this to please, this will please Krishna. Krishna or Prabhupada also would not be pleased if I neglected my ordinary duties. So that in itself, that's part of this definition, doing something favorable. Now there's an interesting part, which I skipped over here, but there's a discussion of why this favorable attitude had to be added there, because the objection is, well, any service to Krishna is fine, that takes care of it, devotional service. But no, the attitude is important, and I think, yes, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he says the definition is overly inclusive and overly exclusive. And he says one of the problems if it's only about whether Krishna is pleased or not. Actually, this is the discussion. It's a little bit hard to understand what's going on, but he gives a couple of examples. And he says, for example, you can say that, well, Kamsa is performing pure devotional service because Krishna is pleased. Why is Krishna pleased? Because he wants to fight, and he's, you know, getting out, whatever. It's part of Krishna's bhava or an enjoyment to fight with demons. So you could say, well, the demon must be pleasing Krishna because Krishna is pleased. But I said, no, that's not what the definition is about. And the other one is that sometimes Krishna may be displeased by what the person is doing, but it may be a devotee who's displeasing. And he gives the example of Mother Yashoda, that Krishna became so angry that he broke the butter pot and fed the yogurt to them, and tears came. He was actually really angry. The word is there in the Bhagavatam. So that the idea there, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying, is that the attitude of the devotee is what's important. So that's part of the definition of devotional service, the attitude. So like you're saying, especially if one is, you know, has this conscious idea that I'm doing these things, especially when they're difficult. You know, in the first six items of devotional service in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, one of them is Chagena Krishna Bogadi Chagena Krishna Hetave. For the cause of Krishna, one may have to give up things that one likes and accept things that one and do things that one doesn't like. So this comes right in the beginning. It's one, sort of one of the overriding principles of the 64 items of devotional service. So things may be difficult, ordinary practices, but if you think, no, I'm doing this to please Krishna, will be pleased. If I neglect this, Krishna won't be pleased. So we're putting Krishna again, we're putting Krishna into the equation, and that attitude of wanting to please Krishna is really what, you know, saturates the activity, you can say, with the pure devotion, the attitude of pure devotion. So these things, it seems like they can all be encompassed, all the things we do in our life under that umbrella.
I have some chat room comments and questions. This is from Mother Nandini Kishori. She quotes Prabhupada, morning walk, June 7, 1976, Los Angeles. Rameshwar, so I have been told that if one fasts on Bhoimi Ekadashi, Bhima Ekadashi, that it is like fasting on all Ekadashi. Is that true? Prabhupada, yes. Ekadashi is meant for fasting, either Bhima or Arjuna. But we cannot fast, therefore we have to take little fruits, and otherwise Ekadashi means fasting.
So I don't know, sort of ambiguous whether he answered the question or not. I think Prabhupada's saying maybe because it's also called Pandava Nirjalai. So Pandava can be Arjuna, Pandava can be Bhima. That may be what Prabhupada's...
Yeah.
No,
I think Prabhupada's just saying Bhima, Arjuna, whatever,
you know. Yeah,
right. We should do fasting, but...
But he's saying also, he's not making the point about if you broke the Ekadasi, this will take care of it.
Then there is a question from other... Anyway, it's one devotee. One should not worship the deity without first worshipping the demigod Ganapati, who drives away all impediments in the execution of devotional service. Nectar of Devotion, Chapter 8. So what is your...
That's, I think, maybe in the same place where it says you should worship Ganesh.
Yeah.
When devotees first read that, they were thinking, what? We're not worshipping Ganesh? So, actually, Bhaktidas, it just happens to me in my initiation letter, when he wrote the Prabhupada, he asked Prabhupada about worshipping Ganesh. And what did Prabhupada say? You have to give $100,000 a month, is that what it was? I think, yeah. You can worship Ganesh if you can give me $100,000 a month. So basically, Prabhupada just said, don't worry about it. Essentially, what he said was, don't worry about it. And our Acharya, Narottam Das Thakur, he says, don't be distracted by worshipping the demigods. So, and this idea about, you know, getting rid of obstacles, we worship Nrisimhadev for doing that. Or, of course, we can worship any of our acharyas for doing that. They certainly have more power than the demigods do. They're intimate associates of Krishna. So we don't have to worry about, you know, in our line.
This three, you can just read from one by one.
What am I reading down here?
Just the bottom.
Prabhu, can you discuss a little the concept of liberation versus desire to go back to Godhead? Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually. Good. Usually when we say no desire for liberation, it means impersonal liberation. We're not desiring impersonal liberation. But at least, well, in our conditioned state, naturally the desire is there to want to get out of this world, and that's encouraged. How many times did Prabhupada say, and go back home, back to Godhead? So many of his lectures, they end, and go back home, back to Godhead. So he encouraged us to do that. But then there's another stage. There are different ways of looking at these things. So there's another perception there. Well, I'm already in, like, I'm already with Krishna in the spiritual world. But still, you can't discount the desire to be with Krishna. This is allowed. Radharani wants to be with Krishna. So it's allowed to want to be with Krishna. So if you say, well, that's desiring for liberation, well, if it is, that's all right. Devotee will say, okay, I don't care if it is or not, I want to be with Krishna. So that's fine. We can want to go back to Godhead. So let's see.
It's from Mother Swami.
Where does it start? Very interesting that the appearance of Ganga and Ganga Mata Goswamini is the same. Well, that's from yesterday. Let's see. Srila Prabhupada said that we serve our family. Okay, so this must be the relevant. Srila Prabhupada said that we serve our family as servants of Krishna primarily, and our family members secondarily. Queen Kunti's prayers for removing her attachments to the Vrishnis and Pandavas. Of course, yes, Kunti Devi said, because Kunti Devi was torn because she has two families. I was just reading an explanation of this the other day. Must have been in the Preeti Sandarbha, which I just started reading. Because she was torn because, well, if Krishna goes to Dwarka, then her family in Hastinapur is going to miss out on Krishna. And if he stays in Hastinapur, then her family in Dwarka was going to be missing out on Krishna. So she was torn between these two. She didn't want either of them to suffer. So she didn't want Krishna to go either place or leave either place. So that was, of course, you can see, that's her bhava, really. But still, she's, you know, on another level. She's, Prabhupada talks in the purport there about how she was disparaging attachment due to skin disease. If it's about the body only, that's it. This is specific to discussion, so please read, but I don't have it here. I don't want to read the whole purport. It's late anyway. So that's basically the idea.
I have one more. This is from Mother Vishnupriya. Srila Prabhupada gave us the essentials to make it easier for us to progress in spiritual life. But today, so many additional holidays, personalities, etc. have been added. It's overwhelming. Can you comment?
Like so many issues in ISKCON, this one has a whole spectrum. Some people think, oh, it should be the way it was in 1966, always. Or maybe 1977, I suppose. But there are things in Prabhupada's books where, just like sometimes devotees are very, very, you know, insistent that only read Prabhupada's books. But in Prabhupada's books, he tells us, for example, to read the writings of the Goswamis. He quotes the song saying that if you want to understand Radha and Krishna, you have to get the blessings of the Goswamis, and he takes that as studying the teachings of the Goswamis. So, you know, things come in, but also, you know, we've been around for a long time. It's natural to want to increase. There's a whole infinity of Krishna conscious things, and it's natural for devotees to want to explore those things. Of course, we always have to do them with Prabhupada's teachings in mind. But the overriding principle, of course, is accept what's favorable and reject what's unfavorable. So that, in some ways, we have to judge that for ourselves. Is this helping me in Krishna consciousness? Is this inspiring me? I often say this about reading. I was mentioning not too long ago that I tend to read, you know, philosophical things rather than like the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, which I know some devotees really love those things, those books. And I'm not discrediting them. But sometimes I make the point, well, just read something instead of reading, you know, Time magazine or whatever. Maybe it's hard for you to read the Goswamis. Well, read the Mahabharata, which Prabhupada didn't translate. But. So anyway, the idea is whatever helps you advance in Krishna consciousness. And if you need some guidance, then, you know, take guidance from others. But I don't think we should be too, you know, critical of what devotees do. I think there can also be maybe sometimes over nostalgia for the old days. I have to admit sometimes when I hear, like, especially on Vyas Puja days, when devotees talk about how fired up we were and back in those days, and I think not everybody was fired up. People were blooping back then too. I remember temple presence having problems to engaging people. I remember I was a fairly new devotee. I'll just give this one example. And there was one devotee there who was hard to engage. And the temple president told me, he says, you know, it's funny, whenever I go into this devotee's room to ask him to do service, he's always chanting Gayatri. every time I open his door, there he is with his thread. So there have always been struggles in Krishna consciousness. It's not that everyone was, you know, running out to the Sankirtan van and getting out to the street. And so we can kind of, you know, paint a rosy picture of how great things were in the past. No, devotees have always struggled in Krishna consciousness. And devotees are getting, you know, there are so many, in many ways, it's kind of has, you know, it's like a flower blossoming. So many things are coming out, you know. It's like we have these beautiful Harinam festivals of the Holy Name, how that's grown all over the movement. It's such a wonderful thing. Somebody could say, well, we didn't do that when Prabhupada was here. You know, you're going to criticize that? Hundreds or thousands in the Russia, they have thousands of devotees come together. Beautiful music, people may criticize. Oh, the music is too beautiful, you know. Bhaktisiddhanta like people singing off key or whatever, you know. So, you know, we can get a little, go a little overboard on these things, I think.
She's adding, or is this expansion to help people of other culture to come to Krishna consciousness? It's a question.
This is part of the same question?
Yeah.
Are these... Oh, well, that's another whole side of preaching. How do you preach? This is always an ongoing discussion. What's allowable? That, again, is you judge by the results. And devotees have different ways. I was just on one conference where devotees were discussing this. And, you know, how much, like, devotees teach yoga, which is a kind of a common thing these days, to bring people into Krishna consciousness. So devotees have different approaches to it. One devotee, he teaches yoga, he builds it as yoga, he builds it as bhakti yoga, and as soon as the first day of class, he says, I'm not going to teach you any asanas here. I'm going to tell you what bhakti yoga is about. It's not about asanas. And another devotee, he teaches hatha yoga, and then he says, well, hatha yoga is based on Bhagavad Gita, so he injects Bhagavad Gita here and there and tries to bring people along that way. So devotees have their own initiative, their own inspiration. They're trying to bring people to Krishna consciousness as best they can. So ultimately, Krishna will be the judge. Krishna will be, of course, if they're sincerely desiring to spread Krishna consciousness, then Krishna is pleased just by that attempt, by that attitude. So that's another thing, you know, of course, people can go overboard, they can mix in things, and there's always, you know, we can always second guess, well, I don't know if they should be doing that, and you know, so. One thing I think is an important principle is that not all of us should be critics of everything that goes on in the whole ISKCON world, you know, judging everything and questioning people's motives, and I don't think this is right, and that's not so good. We have to give people the benefit of the doubt, as we say. I think it's always better to think, well, this is a sincere devotee. This devotee is trying to serve Krishna. Better that's our attitude, even if it's wrong. Especially if it doesn't affect me personally, better that I have that attitude. No, this person, just like we have certain, even philosophical disagreements in ISKCON about certain fundamental things, even among Prabhupada's followers. So it's better to take the attitude, well, this person that's just the way the person thinks. Maybe in my next life I'll think that way, I don't know. And this person sincerely wants to serve Srila Prabhupada. I may disagree with how this person is doing it, but at least try to have that positive attitude. You know, there's that, it's considered to be an offense not to be happy to see devotees. So we should be happy that people are trying to serve Krishna. And even if they might be doing it in a way that I think is questionable, well, we'll see. Krishna will ultimately be the judge.
One more quotation on the previous Ekadashi quote, Tamal Krishna. If it is possible, should we go without eating at all? Prabhupada, yes, but don't lie down and sleep. Pushta Krishna, as long as it does not affect one's service, one can fast all day. Yes.
Yeah, so Prabhupada is very practical about it. If you can do it, do it. The other thing, you know, it's just natural that people have certain aptitudes about many things. There are devotees who are fasting. Maybe some of them are doing it and it's really, really hard for them. Whereas others, it may not be so hard. I mean, I know devotees were fasting before they became devotees. They, you know, for health reasons or whatever. People are doing that still, people outside. They do intermittent fasts. But others, maybe I know some devotees, as soon as they just can't handle it. They just can't do it. They feel too weak, they get splitting headaches, and they can't do anything. So we have different, again, aptitudes on doing these things too. And we also have different convictions about it, I suppose you can say. Some devotees think this is really, really important. I want to do that. So if you feel that way, great. And Prabhupada would encourage that. That's the idea here. Yeah, Prabhupada, he would never, I think there's a walk somewhere where Prabhupada saw someone doing some asana, maybe the shirsasana, standing on the head. And devotees were downplaying it. And Prabhupada said, No, Prabhupada said, no, this is good. It's good for the health. And he would say, but you will not do because you're too lazy. Something like that. So, don't criticize. Some things, you know, they can be good, and if you can do it, then do it. That was basically Prabhupada's idea here. Yeah, it's fast. If you can fast, that's fine. But if you can't do it, then don't kill yourself and not do any service because you're fasting all day. All right. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I don't have any more. Okay, we have another question here. I'm always trying to escape, but let's see. It says, I have no questions. Oh. If only devotees who think that Prabhupada's original editions are the only way, so to speak, could adopt the attitude that you were just discussing, that those devotees who edited the Bhagavatam after he left are sincere, in other words. Wow. That would be a nice attitude to take for editors. Myself being one, I like that edit. Okay, Hare Krishna.
On WhatsApp,
you don't know.
Or I need email to send.
The one that's online, the one that is there. I'm pretty sure it's online. Yeah, it's online.